As we continue our series of Psalms in the summer, our text this week is Psalm 101. This psalm is frequently torn out of its context and impressed into the service of very political gospels, which are no gospels at all. This psalm could very easily be mistaken to be a charter for extreme self-righteousness and perhaps some kind of holy vigilante for God. Please don't do that. The psalm was written by David most likely when he knew he was God's choice to be the king, but was waiting for years. When will this crown finally come to him? When can he finally stop running from those who want to take his life? And what he's doing here is mimicking what we see very often in the ancient Near East, what's called a vassal vow. You've heard these languages, these terms before, I imagine. The suzerain in those cultures was the great king, maybe as we conceive of an emperor, a king over other smaller kingdoms. And the lesser kings that ruled those smaller kings were called vassals. And they would be forced to take vows of loyalty to the great king. To say, yes, I will do as you've said. I will govern as you've called me to. I'll be loyal to you. So David is making a very similar vow here that when he is king, he is going to honor the Lord. And particularly the phrase that comes up often is he's going to walk in the way of integrity. Unlike the king that was seeking his life for so many of his days. Hear now the word of the Lord. Psalm 101 verse 1. I will sing of faithful love and justice. I will sing praise to you, Lord. I will pay attention to the way of integrity. When will you come to me? I will live with a heart of integrity in my house. I will not set anything worthless before my eyes. I hate the practice of transgression. It will not cling to me. A devious heart will be far from me. I will not be involved with evil. I will destroy anyone who secretly slanders his neighbor. I cannot tolerate anyone with haughty eyes or an arrogant heart. My eyes favor the faithful of the land so that they may sit down with me. The one who follows the way of integrity may serve me. No one who acts deceitfully will live in my palace. No one who tells lies will remain in my presence. Every morning I will destroy all the wicked of the land, eliminating all evildoers from the Lord's city. The word of the Lord. Okay, kids. It's one of the... We have a lot of these awkward transitions, don't we? Kids, all eyes and ears up here. Often I know when we read the Bible, it's hard to understand sometimes, and it might make you think that this is just for the grown-ups, but it's not. God wants you to know what his word says to you because he loves you. He really loves you, kids, and he wants you to know that. And it's also important that you, kids, know how you can show God that you love him. So let me ask you a question. Do you kids wish that you were in charge of things more than you are? I see a lot of honest heads nodding. Would you love to be your own boss? With no one to tell you what to do, you can just make all your choices the way you want? Yeah. Well, what about this, though? What if you could be in charge of everybody else and tell them what to do? Would you love that? I see lots of future tyrants in the making. I'm glad you kids are honest. We all want to be in charge, don't we? We don't like having to obey other people's rules sometimes. Well, if you were in charge of everything, do you think you would do a good job? Or do you think maybe you would do a bad job sometimes? Would you always want to do what's best for everybody if you were in charge? Or would you a lot of times just do what you want? Here's where the honesty is waning a little bit, I think. I think a lot of our selfishness, if we were in charge, a lot of times we would just do what we want. And what's important is that we would do what God wants. Did you know that you are in charge of things? God has said that all of us are to rule parts of this earth. Not because we're kings or queens, but God has said that he's given us a little bit of his power and authority to take care of this world and to take care of each other. And do we do a good job of that? Do we take care of his world and each other very well? We all could do a lot better, couldn't we? Is God going to fire us because we don't rule very well? Nope. Why wouldn't he fire us? Why wouldn't he say, you're not acting like me, get out of here? Because Jesus did it perfectly for us. Did he care for everyone around him perfectly? Yep. Did he care for God's world perfectly? Yep. And if he did it perfectly, God looks at you like you did it perfectly if you trust in Jesus. And all the times you don't do it perfectly, Jesus said, punish me for that, not them. Isn't that amazing he wanted to do that? So when you see other people, God has called you to help care for them and help care for this world. And when you're finding yourself not doing it well, not caring for your brothers and sisters and parents and friends, remember what Jesus did for you. So you can help try more and more, realizing God's not going to get rid of me. He's not going to fire me. He loves me just like Jesus. And that makes you want to love others like he loves you. Thank you, kids, for listening. So as I said, this is the vow of a vassal, a lesser king, to a suzerain, the great king. I'm going to rule loyally to you. And so, as I said to the kids, though we aren't kings over a theocracy like David, we are image bearers of God. And that, what does it mean that we are image bearers, that we are God's image? One of the first things the word tells us, male and female, he created them in the image of God. Does it mean we look like him? Most certainly not, though that is a theory out there. God is a spirit and doesn't look like anything. No, being an image bearer is a job. It's a commission. Go rule my world as I would. There's a term thrown around in theological circles. We are vicegerents or vice regents, vice rulers. He is king, and he has said, rule this portion of what I give you in a way that honors me. So it doesn't mean we all have little kingdoms that are our own. It's his kingdom, and he has called us to treat others and this world as he would. So don't hear me saying, okay, I want this to be something you really do hear me say, that this psalm is symbolic. It's not actually about David being king. It's all symbolizing how we are all kings. It's not. It's really truly about David saying, I'm going to rule faithfully. But how would that speak to people who aren't kings and queens over theocracies in the ancient world? It would say, well, if this is how God calls his rulers to rule, how would he call us to rule with what he has given us to care for until he returns? So how should we rule with integrity? First point, we need to understand, over what do we rule? Over what do we rule? Second, what does integrity look like in these situations? What does integrity look like in these situations? And then finally, from where does our strength come to rule this way? From where does our strength come to rule this way? So as I said, none of us are kings or queens over a theocratic nation or over anything. Okay. So it's very important we don't just look at this and say, well, David says he can destroy evildoers. I guess I can. David says he will not let any evil live in his house. I guess I can get rid of the people that I don't want at my house. David is looking down on those who slander. I guess I can look down on those who slander. Most certainly not. The king was in a unique situation there, in a covenant under which, sorry, the sentence already didn't work. Let me abort it. Under a different covenant than we are under. The old covenant was about a nation, a physical nation of Israel. They were ruled by God, but he put a king in place because they were faithless and said, we want a king like the other nations. And God had already prophesied that would happen. Actually, in Deuteronomy 17, ages before Saul ever became king, God said this, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, take possession of it, live in it, and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations around me. You are to appoint over you the king the Lord your God chooses. Appoint a king from your own brothers. You are not to set a foreigner over you or one who is not of your own people. However, he must not acquire many horses for himself or send the people back to Egypt to acquire many horses, for the Lord has told you, you are never to go back that way again. He must not acquire many wives for himself so that his heart won't go astray. He must not acquire very large amounts of silver or gold for himself. When he is seated on his royal throne, he is to write a copy of this instruction for himself on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. It is to remain with him, and he is to read from it all the days of his life so that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, to observe all the words of his instruction, and to do these statutes. Then his heart will not be exalted above his countrymen. He will not turn from this command to the right or to the left, and he and his sons will continue ruling many years over Israel. How well did that go? Not very. Almost immediately, this was ignored. But you can see God had specific instructions for a king over his nation. And the old covenant was a physical situation where if you obeyed, God would allow you to live in that land. It wasn't up for all nations to take up if they wanted to give it a shot, and it's most certainly not on the table for America, even though you hear quite different things on 4th of July sermons. They were his nation, and they could remain that if they obeyed. They did not. And so as he also prophesied, they were exiled. It wasn't a failed attempt, an experiment on God's part. It was an object lesson for all of us. If you think you can dwell in God's kingdom based on your works, look at Israel. You cannot. So do we give up? No. Give up relying on yourself and wait for that Messiah who's coming, because we can't dwell in his kingdom based on our works. He will do that for us. He will bring us a kingdom based on his works that will give us hope forever. So he did. That covenant and kingdom is gone. The old one is gone. Christ's kingdom is here. The new covenant is here. It's based on Christ's finished work, and it's not recognized by nations or national boundaries or ethnic peoples. There is no Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, barbarian or Scythian. All those categories are gone, not physically, but spiritually they're gone. Anyone who trusts in Christ, no matter who you are, is part of this kingdom. Therefore, it doesn't wage physical war like the old covenant kingdom did. They were told, go kill those people. They are God's enemies. We are told, love our enemies and pray for those who persecute us. Our enemy is spiritual. We fight a spiritual war with spiritual armor, contrary to what you hear on the right and on the left in much of American theology. And so, if it's not known by national boundaries, if it's a spiritual kingdom, how does it function? And how do we apply that then to how we rule in this spiritual kingdom? Paul in 2 Corinthians 10 gives us one of the most helpful explanations of what this kingdom looks like and how it operates. In 2 Corinthians 10:3, he says, for though we live in the world, we don't wage war the way the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ. Physical, earthly kingdoms take captive people and cities. We demolish arguments, Paul says, and we take captive thoughts. That's how this works. The battle is not against flesh and blood, Paul says, but against principalities and powers in the heavenly realms. And so if we're going to be ruling in a spiritual kingdom, how do we operate according to those terms? And how do we learn from the way David, as a physical king, vowed to rule before God? I think that we need to look at the spheres of responsibility that God puts in our lives and how we would rule or govern or take care of these things as a way to honor our true king. The ones I'm going to focus on here are ourselves, our families, and our church. So to our second point, over what do we rule? It's ourselves, our families, and our church. And when I say rule, we are stewards. What is a steward? The king goes away and says, take care of this while I'm gone. I expect it to be in good order when I come back. So how do we steward ourselves, our families, and our church? So, That brings us to our second point. What does integrity look like in those situations as we steward ourselves, our families, and our church? Let's hear from David again in verse 3. I will not set anything worthless before my eyes. I hate the practice of transgression. I will not let it cling to me. A devious heart will be far from me. I will not be involved with evil. I will destroy anyone who secretly slanders his neighbor. I cannot tolerate anyone with haughty eyes or an arrogant heart. So again, please, I've coined this term. I'm not sure if I have. I used it with you before. Please do the covenant math here, okay? The king was told by God to use the sword to destroy those who did not obey the law. You are not called to do that. I don't think I'm blowing any of your minds here, but what a charter for self-righteousness if we don't understand the different contexts here. David's not saying, I am so righteous that I, of my own accord, am just going to go out and start killing those who aren't. No, the king was given the sword by God and told in the law of Moses to do these things. So how does that shift to our situation? First of all, what does integrity mean? It's a word we throw around a lot. In the Old Testament and the New, it means living purely and wholeheartedly without mixed motives. We're living blamelessly, uprightly, honestly. And so how can we bring those things to the areas where God has called us to steward what he's given us? So what we see David saying here essentially is, I am not going to surround myself with yes men. And that's what kings often did. Let me surround myself with those who are just going to puff me up, tell me what I want to hear, they're never going to oppose me, and then I'll always get what I want. And David's saying, I'm not going to listen to people who are going to lie to me. I'm not going to surround myself with advisors who are going to tell me things that aren't true. Those who are proud and arrogant and deceitful are not going to be in my courts. They're not going to be in my palace. I want to surround myself with those who are going to tell me the truth. Even if it's inconvenient, if it's humbling, if it's things I don't want to hear, I need to surround myself with those who point me to the truth so I can walk in the way of integrity. So what would this mean for us? How do we surround ourselves with people who are going to tell us the truth, with sources that are going to give us the truth that might humble us, might convict us, might not be things we want to hear? How can we avoid those deceitful voices that are convenient and comfortable, and instead point to the truth? I think we go back to 2 Corinthians 10. I think this is what it means when Paul says we take captive every thought. I can't go capture your thoughts, but I can take mine captive with the help of the Spirit. So if David is saying, I'm not letting dishonest voices influence me, I will not listen to slander and lies, I'm not going to let worthless things be in front of me before my eyes. I'm instead going to look at the truth. What does that mean as we steward ourselves, our families, and our church? What voices do you permit to influence you? Go ahead and think about it. What voices do you surround yourself with? I don't mean necessarily literal voices. It can obviously be what you read as well. What determines your choices for what I'm going to have entering my mind and shaping the way I think? Is it just what's convenient? I don't have time to have one more thing challenge me right now. Every other voice around me is just constantly on my back. I'm just going to listen to things that make me feel good. Do you fill your life with as many yes men as you can find? I was reading, I don't endorse The Onion, even though I reference it often. It does tell stark truths. I saw a headline recently that said, neurotic woman turns to neurotic friends for help. And that should be true. That's true of all of us. I'm in a situation, probably of my own making. I don't want to admit that it's of my own making. So how can I find people who do the same things to make me realize, oh, this isn't a problem at all? It's right for me to act this way, and everyone else is telling me it is. I love it this way. Maybe you just fill your life with noise to drown out the conscience or the Spirit of God as it convicts, because we don't want to deal with things we know need to change. I think these things are epidemic in our fragmented virtual culture, especially. It is so easy to create an echo chamber around yourself, whether it's online or not, only telling me what I want to hear, only with people who like what I like, who agree with what I agree with, who support what I support, and I'm not going to even interact with those who think differently. Surrounding ourselves with those who make it easy to just hear what I want to hear does not reflect the integrity that says, I want to surround myself with the truth, whether it's things I want to hear or not. And when we look at the descriptions that are throughout, particularly Paul's epistles, of how the church should be interacting with each other, it is iron sharpening iron. It is people lovingly confronting each other. It is people saying to those who have sinned, I'm going to help restore you gently. But we have to restore you because what you're doing now is not okay. What worthless things, to quote David again, do you put before your eyes? Right away, I cringed when I was writing this stuff, because any of us who grew up in the church are so familiar with the middle school talks and the high school talks about don't watch this, don't read that, and I don't want to come across that way. However, these things come up a lot for a reason. So I'm not trying to be just a clucking tongue and a wagging finger here, but what do you permit before your eyes? And don't just hear me saying, what are you watching on screens? Though that most certainly counts. How much of what we put before our eyes is not just immoral, but just simply a waste of time? When we decide, what am I going to spend my time either reading or watching or whatever else, are there any aspects of our choice making there that are first and foremost concerned with how can I glorify God with this activity I'm about to engage in? I will suggest to you, if you're anything like me, if you do finally get a chance to do such things, glorifying God is not on your mind, because right now I'm entering into that sweet me time. Finally, my feet are up. My chores are done. I just want to unwind, and I'm not thinking at all, how could this time be used best to shape me in a way that I am filling myself or putting before my eyes things that are going to make me honor the Lord more? I just want to have some fun, for crying out loud. And don't I deserve it after all I've done? Please don't hear me, and I beg you. Like, if I need to do it like an eyes up here kind of thing right now, I'm going to do it. Please, 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 please don't hear me saying, you can only ever watch Christian shows, read Christian books, and listen to Christian music. I'm not saying that. There's a whole lot of worthless Christian books you can read out there, okay? What I'm saying is, are you seeking to engage with things that tell you the truth? With things that are going to mold you and shape you? And I think many of our hobbies absolutely can fit into that. But am I doing it to glorify the Lord, or am I doing it to build my own kingdom the way I want, because I deserve it? And I'm very guilty of everything I'm condemning right now. I'm guessing you struggle with it too. How much of what we put before our eyes or what we fill our ears with conforms with Paul's exhortation in Philippians 4? Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any moral excellence and if there's any praise, dwell on these things. Much of God's creation that's not under the specific moniker Christian can tell us these things. So don't hear me saying you can only ever watch Christian things. But what's my goal? What's my desire with these things that I fill my heart and mind with? If we are ignoring the way of integrity, the determining factor is, it's what I want. It's what's convenient. It's what makes me feel good. That's what matters most. I just want to be entertained. Entertainment isn't wrong. at all. It's a gift from God if we get a chance to be entertained in a fallen and broken world. It's a gift. Do we treat it as a gift from God or as an entitlement that we have a right to? So how do we take our thoughts captive when so many other voices are trying to capture them and take them off the path of integrity? Well, we see David vowed fairly extreme action to guard against these things. He's going to banish, he's going to destroy, he's going to wipe out. Well, we, again, are not called to be banishing people and most certainly not be called to destroy people. But what steps are you willing to take as we look at David's vows of extreme action to guard against things that would take him off the way of integrity? What steps are you willing to take to guard what is shaping your mind and your thoughts as well? And I don't know at all what each of you are struggling with. I can't say, oh, I know what you need to go sacrifice. I know what you need to stop watching. I know what podcast you got to stop listening to. I have no idea. But I guarantee all of us could spend a whole lot more time and effort seeking to honor the Lord with what we fill our minds with, what we allow to shape our thoughts. If we're to take these thoughts captive to obedience to Christ, as Paul says, how often are we opening ourselves up to other things that are trying to capture them? And I think there's a real difference there. There's a difference between being captivated and being captured. If I'm being captivated, I'm opening myself up to something that is just dazzling me and maybe controlling me. Not always a bad thing. If I'm being captured, something has taken me against my will. I think we open ourselves up to be captivated by things that want to capture us. And we are told to, no, you take your thoughts, you take what you dwell on, and you take it captive to Christ. So we saw David take extreme action. What would that extreme action look like for us in the new covenant? Those who aren't, we're not wielding swords, we're not banishing people from palaces. What does this activity look like as we seek to take our thoughts captive to obedience to Christ? I think we see the counterpart to David's extreme action as Paul explains these things in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, in the analogy of what athletes do in training. In verse 24, Paul says, "Don't you know that runners in a stadium all race, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way as to win the prize. Now everyone who competes exercises self-control in everything. However, they do it to receive a crown that will fade away, but we for a crown that will never fade away. Therefore, I do not run like one who runs aimlessly or box like one beating the air. Instead, I discipline my body." Other translations say, "I beat my body to bring it under strict control." There's many other instances where Paul describes the effort required from us to take our thoughts captive to obedience to Christ. This is a great one. Effort is involved. However, we would be in serious theological error if we made the effort sound as though it starts with us. And that is so common in many versions of Christianity. All right, I died for you. I saved you. I brought you out of the pit. Now you show a little gratitude and get to work. It's most certainly not what Christian, what we call sanctification, being made into the image of Christ, looks like. But it's very easy to think that way because a lot of the world operates that way. After all I did for you, get to work and show me a little gratitude. It wouldn't be wrong for God to do that. It's just that he's chosen to do something far more beautiful, far more helpful to people who struggle to take our thoughts captive, who struggle to walk with integrity the way that we do. So please know that this second point is far longer than point three. Don't start sweating here. But there's some brief other areas I want to talk about too. I think the biggest battle for us to walk with integrity, the biggest area of our ruling that we need to fight with is against our old nature in taking our thoughts captive. So if you're looking to this way of integrity language in Psalm 101, you're thinking, yeah, what other people can I go start getting rid of? What other people can I start confronting? I know one slanderer who I'm going to start dealing with. I know this guy who's not righteous. It's time to get them out of my life. Please don't think that way. The first area you're going to do battle with, and the one you're going to do more battle in than any other, is your own heart and mind. There's the biggest battlefield you'll ever face, the side of heaven. Start there. We've been told to take our thoughts captive. That's where the way of integrity is going to meet most of our time and effort. However, there are others that God has put in your care. And kids, if he hasn't put them in your care yet, he will in the future. We are told to steward or care for our families as we would unto the Lord. But we're also, we wear other hats. God has put other people in our care. If you're an employer, if you're a parent, if you're a teacher, if you're an administrator, and probably a whole lot of other hats we could think of, there are people you are governing, people you're in charge of. And the way you care for them, teach them, guide them, instruct them, whatever else, absolutely reflects the king you under which you serve. What steps are you taking in these areas of responsibility to walk in the way of integrity? Are you just trying to get the job done? Just make it through another day? And don't hear me, by the way, just dismissing how difficult many of your situations are. I know they're very difficult. Getting through another day for many of you is a huge, huge task. But in the midst of it, are we doing so to walk in the way of integrity, to point those God has put under our care toward him and his glory? Are you seeking to shield those under your care from forces that would destroy them, from lies that would affect them? What are you doing to help them walk in the way of integrity themselves? And what are you doing to value those who do walk with integrity? Are you going out of your way to make sure they are shown, yes, that is right, and commending those things? That's what we see David do in verse 6. My eyes favor the faithful of the land so that they may sit down with me. The one who follows the way of integrity may serve me. No one who acts deceitfully will serve in my palace. No one who tells lies will remain in my presence. Again, how arrogant would it be if you applied this literally? If you are righteous enough, you may serve me, okay? Please don't go there. But if there are those in our care, whether it's at work, at home, whatever it is, are we seeking to value the integrity they show, to build them up and encourage them in these things? Or do we have perhaps some shameful chapters, particularly in a workplace or as a parent, when they have shown more integrity than we did and we couldn't bear the shame of acknowledging that? It's crucial for us to build them up in these things, even if it means admitting wrong on our part, to help all of us walk in the way of integrity. And finally, God has called each of you to care for his church. Some in different ways. If you're an officer, an elder, a deacon, or me, a pastor, there are different responsibilities given. But all of us are called to build each other up, to confront one another, to serve each other. We're all called to perhaps even confront in a way that's more specific, even beginning the path of Matthew 18 and church discipline. It begins, first and foremost, not with officers, but with you. Loving each other enough to not simply just hold a grudge or be angry, but to deal with the things that we often fail in. We need each other to point these things out because none of us is going to do it well enough on our own. And we see how important this is to Paul so often when he says, expel the immoral brother from you in 1 Corinthians 5. The full breadth of excommunication. Or elsewhere, if someone sins, falls into sin, you restore them gently. Love them enough to care. Paul will talk elsewhere about removing leaven from among us. It's important that we are watching what each other believes and does. And if there is false teaching pervading through the church, that's going to be leaven that destroys the whole lump of dough, Paul says. We just preached through Jude when Jude says, guard carefully, faithfully, the teaching entrusted to you once and for all. The faith once and for all delivered to the saints, he described. We have to guard those things. We steward God's church, this side of heaven, until he brings us home. Do we want a church that is preaching the truth, even if it means work on our part to care for these things? Or we just want something that feels good, that doesn't make me have to lift yet another finger in one more area of my life? If our church is a family, which it is, we need to view it that way and care for each other in easy things and hard things the way God has called us to, with integrity. The last line of this psalm is perhaps particularly difficult to do the covenant math with. Every morning I will destroy all the wicked of the land, eliminating all evildoers from the Lord's city. This is not I love the smell of the blood of the wicked in the morning. Okay, the every morning language is describing not so much, you know, your alarm goes off and like, okay, who am I going to destroy today? No, it's the idea of this is not going to be a chore we complete. Every day we get up again and ask the Lord's help. Help me walk with integrity with all that you have put before me. We don't put our feet up this side of heaven and say, finally did it. I am mayor of Integrityville, and everything is finally the way it should be. It will never happen. It takes continued vigilance, taking our thoughts captive, caring for those the Lord has put in our lives, and caring for his church. Because every one of those situations is populated 100% by sinners. So the way of integrity is going to be natural to none of those situations and none of the people involved. So if that's the kind of task that's before us, how in the world do we get the strength to continue to walk in the way of integrity? I think it's crucial that we see, this is our final point, where David begins. I will sing of faithful love and justice. I will sing praise to you, Lord. I'll pay attention to the way of integrity. When will you come to me? Justice is a common translation here of the word there, and it makes sense because he's acknowledging the way God rules, but most often that word is translated judgment or verdict. And faithful love here is the language we use. It's so common in Scripture. We sing about it every week. It's that phrase, steadfast love. And that always means covenant love, love based on promises God has made that he will keep. David has made some pretty big vows here, hasn't he? But we know the kind of king he ended up being. Pretty good one as he's measured against the others. But he did commit adultery. He murdered an innocent man. And later on committed such treason against God by massing his forces, not trusting in God's promises, that thousands of people died via plague because of David's sin. David made some big vows. David did not keep these perfectly. So, if someone like David or people like us are going to praise God, I'm going to sing of your justice, we better have something protecting us from that justice, because all of us deserve to be done away with, as David deserved for being a murderer, adulterer, and traitor. What David is saying here is, I am singing of your steadfast love, your covenant promises, and the verdict, the judgment you have rendered over someone like me. What did David say elsewhere? Blessed is the man whose sin the Lord does not count against him, whose sins are covered. That's the verdict David is singing about. And God's steadfast love promises, I will always treat you in light of the judgment I've rendered over you. And that is just. God is keeping promises. It's just to do so. It's unjust not to. So David can now copy that same justice as a king, saying, yes, I stand on the verdict you've rendered over me. It's my only hope. I stand on the judgment you've rendered, saying you will not treat me as my sins deserve. I will sing of that. And you see his reckoning in the very beginning. When will you come to me? I need you if this is going to happen. I don't have what it takes on my own to just be this king of integrity. We need Christ saying, I was walking this way for you. We need Christ saying, I am the one suffering for every time you chose to serve yourself, every yes man you surrounded yourself with, every worthless thing you put before your eyes. I have asked the Father to kill me for that, not you. remembering what's been done for us like that. Remembering that it's for traitors and murderers and adulterers like us. Fills us with such awe that we've been loved like that, that it makes us want to say, why would I not love you and what you love? Why would I not want to fill my eyes and ears and shape my mind with the things you've told me to, with things that are noble and lovely and commendable? Instead of just saying, what do I feel like? After your love shown to me, I want to love you. I want to walk the way you've called me to. We cannot make progress in these difficult areas if we are not constantly meditating, or as Paul said to us earlier, dwell on these things. Meditate on these things. If we are not meditating on what has been done for us once and for all. Hear the power of the author of Hebrews as he describes what's been done for us once and for all. In Hebrews 7:17, for it has been testified, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So the previous command is annulled because it was weak and unprofitable. For the law perfected nothing, but a better hope is introduced through which we draw near to God. None of this happened without an oath, for others became priests without an oath, but he became a priest with an oath made by the one who said to him, the Lord has sworn, he will not change his mind, you are a priest forever. So Jesus has also become a guarantee of a better covenant. Now many have become Levitical priests since they are prevented by death from remaining in office. But because Christ remains forever, he holds his priesthood permanently. Therefore, he is always able to save those who come to God through him, since he always lives to intercede for them. For this is the kind of high priest we need, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He doesn't need to offer sacrifices every day as high priests do, first for their own sins, then for those of the people. He did this once and for all when he offered himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who are weak, but the promise of the oath, which came after the law, appoints the Son, who has been perfected forever. That's what's been done for you. He has been declared to be perfect in your place, therefore so are you. What convenient truths can compare with this? What yes men ramblings can compare with this hope we have? Let's ask the Lord to fill us with such gratitude for this once and for all permanent work of our high priest Christ, paying for our sins, representing us perfectly before him, that we long to take every thought captive to obedience to him, because it is a joy to do what our Father loves.